Chapter 14 of the Holy Barses, and of the exile of the Bishop of Edessa, and his companions. Barses, whose fame is now great not only in his own city of Edessa, and in neighboring towns, but in Phoenicia, in Egypt, and in the Thebaid, through all which regions he had traveled with the high reputation won by his great virtue, had been relegated by Valens to the island of Aratus. 1. But when the emperor learnt that innumerable multitudes streamed thither, because Barses was full of apostolic grace, and drove out sicknesses with the word, he sent him to Oxyrrhynchus, 2. In Egypt. But there too his fame drew all men to him, and the old man, worthy of heaven, was led off to a remote castle neat the country of the barbarians of that district, by name Pheno. It is said that in Aratus his bed has been preserved to this day, where it is held in very great honor, for many sick persons lie down upon it and by means of their faith recover. Chapter 15 of the persecution which took place at Edessa, and of Eulogius and Protogenes, presbyters of Edessa. Now a second time Valens, after depriving the flock of their shepherd, had set over them in his stead a wolf. The whole population had abandoned the city, and were assembled in front of the town, when he arrived at Edessa. He bade given orders to the prefect, Modestus by name, to assemble the troops, under his orders, who were accustomed to exact the tribute, to take all who were present of the armed force, and by inflicting blows with sticks and clubs, and using if need be their other weapons of war, to disperse the gathering multitude. Early in the morning, while the prefect was executing this order, on his way through the forum he saw a woman holding an infant in her arms, and hurrying along at great speed. She had made light of the troops, and forced her way through their ranks, for a soul fired with divine zeal knows no fear of man, and looks on terrors of this kind as ridiculous sport. When the prefect saw her, and understood what had happened, he ordered her to be brought before him, and inquired whither she was going. "I have heard," said she, "that assaults are being planned against the servants of the Lord. I want to join my friends, in the faith that I may share with them the slaughter inflicted by you." "But the baby," said the prefect, "what in the world are you carrying that for?" "That it may share with me," said she, "the death I long for." When the prefect had heard this from the woman, and through her means discovered the zeal which animated all the people, he made it known to the emperor, and pointed out the uselessness of the intended massacre. "We shall only reap," said he, "a harvest of discredit from the deed, and shall fail to quench these people's spirit." He then would not allow the multitude to undergo the tortures which they had expected, and commanded their leaders, the priests, I mean, and deacons, to be brought before him, and offered them a choice of two alternatives, either to induce the flock to communicate with the wolf, or be banished from the town to some remote region. Then he summoned the mass of the people before him, and in gentle terms endeavored to persuade them to submit to the imperial decrees, urging that it was mere madness for a handful of men, who might soon be counted to withstand the sovereign of so vast an empire. The crowd stood speechless. Then the prefect turned to their leader Eulogius, an excellent man, and said, "Why do you make no answer to what you have heard me say?" "I did not think," said Eulogius, "that I must answer, when I had been asked no question." "But," said the prefect, "I have used many arguments to urge you to a course advantageous to yourselves." Eulogius rejoined that these pleas had been urged on all the multitude, and that he thought it absurd for him to push himself forward and reply, but, he went on, "should you ask me my individual opinion, I will give it you." "Well," said the prefect, "communicate with the emperor." With pleasant irony Eulogius continued, "Has he then received the priesthood as well as the empire?" The prefect then, perceiving that he was not speaking seriously, took it ill, and after heaping reproaches on the old man, added, "I did not say so, you fool. I exhorted you to communicate with those with whom the emperor communicates." To this the old man replied that they had a shepherd, and obeyed his directions, and so 80 of them were arrested, and exiled to Thrace. On their way thither they were everywhere received with the greatest possible distinction, cities and villages coming out to meet them, and honoring them as victorious athletes. But envy armed their antagonists to report to the emperor that what had been reckoned disgrace had really brought great honor on these men. Thereupon Valens ordered that they were to be separated into pairs, and sent in different directions, some to Thrace, some to the furthest regions of Arabia, and others to the towns of the Thebaid, and the saying was that those whom nature had joined together savage men had put asunder, and divided brother from brother. Eulogius, their leader with Protogenes the next in rank, were relegated to Antinoon, 1. Even of these men I will not suffer the virtue to fall into oblivion. They found that the bishop of the city was of like mind with themselves, and so took part in the gatherings of the church. But when they saw very small congregations, and on inquiry learnt that the inhabitants of the city were pagans, they were grieved, as was natural, and deplored their unbelief. But they did not think it enough to grieve, but to the best of their ability devoted themselves to making these men whole. The divine Eulogius, shut up in a little chamber, spent day and night in putting up petitions to the God of the universe, and the admirable Protogenes, who had received a good education, too, and was practiced in rapid writing, pitched on a suitable spot which he made into a boys' school, and, setting up for a schoolmaster, he instructed his pupils not only in the art of swift penmanship, but also in the divine oracles. He taught them the Psalms of David, and gave them to learn the most important articles of the apostolic doctrine. One of the lads fell sick, and Protogenes went to his home, took the sufferer by the hand, and drove away the malady by prayer. When the parents of the other boys heard this, they brought him to their houses, and entreated him to succor the sick, but he refused to ask God for the expulsion of the malady, before the sick had received the gift of baptism. Urged by their longing for the children's health, the parents readily acceded, and won at last salvation both for body and soul. In every instance where he persuaded anyone in health to receive the divine grace, he led him off to Eulogius, and knocking at the door besought him to open, and put the seal of the Lord on the prey. When Eulogius was annoyed at the interruption of his prayer, Protogenes used to say that it was much more essential to rescue the wanderers. In this he was an object of admiration to all who beheld his deeds, doing such wondrous works, imparting to so many the light of divine knowledge, and all the while yielding the first place to another, and bringing his prizes to Eulogius. They rightly conjectured that the virtue of Eulogius was by far the greater and higher. On the quieting of the tempest and restoration of complete calm, they were ordered to return home, and were escorted by all the people, wailing and weeping, and specially by the bishop of the church, who was now deprived of their husbandry. When they reached home, the great Barses had been removed to the life that knows no pain, and the divine Eulogius was entrusted with the rudder of the church which he had piloted, 1, and to the excellent Protogenes was assigned the husbandry of Charae, 2, a barren spot full of the thorns of heathendom, and needing abundant labor. But these events happened after peace was restored to the churches. Chapter 16, of the Holy Basilius, Bishop of Caesarea, and the measures taken against him by Valens, and the prefect Modestus. Valens, one might almost say, deprived every church of its shepherd, and set out for the Cappadocian Caesarea, 3, at that time the see of the great Basil, a light of the world. Now he had sent the prefect before him with orders, either to persuade Basil to embrace the communion of Eudoxius, or, in the event of his refusal, to punish him by exile. Previously acquainted, as he was with the bishop's high reputation, he was at first unwilling to attack him, for he was apprehensive lest the bishop, by boldly meeting and withstanding his assault, should furnish an example of bravery to the rest. This artful stratagem was as ineffective as a spider's web, for the stories told of old were quite enough for the rest of the episcopate, and they kept the wall of the faith unmoved like bastions in the circle of its walls. The prefect, however, on his arrival at Caesarea, sent for the great Basil. He treated him with respect, and, addressing him with moderate and courteous language, urged him to yield to the exigencies of the time, and not to forsake so many churches on account of a petty nicety of doctrine. He moreover promised him the friendship of the emperor, and pointed out that through it he might be the means of conferring great advantages upon many. This sort of talk, said the divine man, is fitted for little boys, for they and their like easily swallow such inducements. But they who are nurtured by divine words will not suffer so much, as a syllable of the divine creeds, to be let go, and for their sake are ready, should need require, to embrace every kind of death. The emperor's friendship I hold to be of great value, if conjoined with true religion, otherwise I doom it for a deadly thing. Then the prefect was moved to wrath, and declared that Basil was out of his senses. But, said the divine man, this madness I pray be ever mine. The bishop was then ordered to retire, to deliberate on the course to be pursued, and on the morrow to declare to what conclusion he had come. Intimidation was moreover joined with argument. The reply of the illustrious bishop is related to have been, I for my part shall come to you tomorrow the same man that I am today. Do not yourself change, but carry out your threats. After these discussions the prefect met the emperor, and reported the conversation, pointing out the bishop's virtue, and the undaunted manliness of his character. The emperor said nothing, and passed in. In his palace he saw that plagues from heaven had fallen, for his son, 1, lay sick at the very gates of death, and his wife, 2, was beset by many ailments. Then he recognized the cause of these sorrows, and entreated the divine man, whom he had threatened with chastisement, to come to his house. His officers performed the imperial behests, and then the great Basil came to the palace. After seeing the emperor's son on the point of death, he promised him restoration to life, if he should receive holy baptism at the hands of the pious, and with this pledge went his way. But the emperor, like the foolish Herod, remembered his oath, and ordered some of the Arian faction, who were present, to baptize the boy, who immediately died. Then Valens repented. He saw how fraught with danger the keeping of his oath had been, and came to the divine temple, and received the teaching of the great Basil, and offered the customary gifts at the altar. The bishop moreover ordered him to come within the divine curtains, where he sat, and talked much with him about the divine decrees, and in turn listened to him. Now there was present a certain man of the name of Demosthenes, 1, superintendent of the imperial kitchen, who in rudely chiding the man who instructed the world was guilty of a solecism of speech. Basil smiled and said, we see he ran illiterate Demosthenes, and on Demosthenes losing his temper, and uttering threats, he continued, your business is to attend to the seasoning of soups. You cannot understand theology, because your ears are stopped up. So he said, and the emperor was so delighted that he gave him some fine lands which he had there for the poor under his care, for they being in grievous bodily affliction were specially in need of care and cure. In this manner then the great Basil avoided the emperor's first attack, but when he came a second time his better judgment was obstructed by counselors, who deceived him. He forgot what had happened on the former occasion, and ordered Basil to go over to the hostile faction, and, failing to persuade him, commanded the decree of exile to be enforced. But when he tried to affix his signature to it he could not even form one tittle of a word, 2, for the pen broke. And when the same thing happened to the second and to the third pen, and he still strove to sign that wicked edict, his hand shook, he quaked, his soul was filled with fright, he tore the paper with both his hands. And so proof was given by the ruler of the world that it was he himself who had permitted these sufferings to be undergone by the rest, but had made Basil stronger than the snares laid against him, and, by all the incidents of Basil's case, had declared his own almighty power, while on the other band he had proclaimed abroad the courage of good men. Thus Valens was disappointed in his attack. Chapter 17 Of the Death of the Great Athanasius, and the Election of Petrus. At Alexandria, Athanasius the Victorious, after all his struggles, each rewarded with a crown, received release from his labors, and passed away to the life which knows no toil. Then Peter, a right excellent man, received the see. His blessed predecessor had first selected him, and every suffrage alike of the clergy, and of men of rank and office concurred, and all the people strove to show their delight by their acclamations. He had shared the heavy labors of Athanasius, at home, and abroad he had been ever at his side, and with him had undergone manifold perils. Wherefore the bishops of the neighborhood hastened to meet, and those who dwelt in schools of ascetic discipline left them, and joined the company, and all joined in begging that Peter might be chosen to succeed to the patriarchal chair of Athanasius. 1. Chapter 18, On the Overthrow of Petrus, and the Introduction of Lucius the Arian. No sooner had they seated him on the episcopal throne, than the governor of the province assembled a mob of Greeks and Jews, surrounded the walls of the church, and bade Peter come forth, threatening him with exile, if he refused. He thus acted on the plea that he was fulfilling the emperor's good pleasure, by bringing those of opposite sentiments into trouble, but the truth was that B was carried away by his impious passion. For B was addicted to the service of the idols, and looked upon the storms which beset the church, as a season of brilliant festivity. The admirable Peter, however, when he beheld the unforeseen conflict, secretly withdrew, and embarked in a vessel bound for Rome. After a few days Aswallo came from Antioch with Lucius, and handed over the churches to him. This was he of whose impiety and lawlessness Samosata had already had experience. But the people nurtured in the teaching of Athanasius, when they now saw how different was the spiritual food offered them, held aloof from the assemblies of the church. Lucius, who employed idolaters as his attendants, went on scourging some, imprisoning others. Some he drove to take to flight, others' homes he rifled in rude and cruel fashion. But all this is better set forth in the letter of the admirable Peter. After recounting an instance of the impious conduct of Lucius, I shall insert the letter in this work. Certain men in Egypt, of angelic life and conversation, fled from the disquiet of the state, and chose to live in solitude in the wilderness. There they made the sandy and barren soil bear fruit, for a fruit right sweet and fair to God was the virtue by whose law they lived. Among many who took the lead in this mode of life was the far-famed Antonius, most excellent master in the school of mortification, who made the desert a training place of virtue for his hermits. He, after all his great and glorious labors, had reached the haven where the winds of trouble blow no more, and then his followers were persecuted by the wretched and unhappy Lucius. All the leaders of those divine companies, the famous Macarius, his namesake, Isidorus, and the rest, 1, were dragged out of their caves, and dispatched to a certain island inhabited by impious men, and never blessed with any teacher of piety. When the ship drew near to the shore of the island, the demon reverenced by its inhabitants departed from the image which had been his time-old home, and filled with frenzy the daughter of the priest. She was driven in her inspired fury to the shore, where the towers were bringing the ship to land. Making the tongue of the girl his instrument, the demon shouted out through her the words uttered at Philippi by the woman possessed with the spirit of Python, too, and was heard by all, both men and women, saying, "Alas, for your power, ye servants of the Christ, everywhere we have been driven forth by you from town and hamlet, from hill and height, from wastes, where no men dwell. In yon islet we had hoped to live out of the reach of your shafts, but our hope was vain. Hither you have been sent by your persecutors, not to be harmed by them, but to drive us out. We are quitting the island, for we are being wounded by the piercing rays of your virtue." With these words, and words like these, they dashed the damsel to the ground, and themselves all fled together. But that divine company prayed over the girl, and raised her up, and delivered her to her father made whole, and in her right mind. The spectators of the miracle flung themselves at the feet of the newcomers, and implored to be allowed to participate in the means of salvation. They destroyed the idol's grove, and, illuminated by the bright rays of instruction, received the grace of holy baptism. On these events becoming known in Alexandria, all the people met together, reviling Lucius, and saying that wrath from God would fall upon them, were not that divine company of saints to be set free. Then Lucius, apprehensive of a tumult in the city, suffered the holy hermits to go back to their dens. Let this suffice to give a specimen of his impious iniquity. The sinful deeds he dared to do will be more clearly set forth by the letter of the admirable Peter. I hesitate to insert it at full length, and so will only quote some extracts from it. Chapter 19, Narrative of Events at Alexandria, in the Time of Lucius the Arian, taken from a letter of Petrus, Bishop of Alexandria. Palladius, governor of the province, by sect to heathen, one, and one who habitually prostrated himself before the idols, had frequently entertained the thought of waging war against Christ. After collecting the forces already enumerated, he set out against the church, as though he were pressing forward to the subjugation of a foreign foe. Then, as is well known, the most shocking deeds were done, and at the bare thought of telling the story, its recollection fills me with anguish. I have shed floods of tears, and I should have long remained thus bitterly affected had I not assuaged my grief by divine meditation. The crowds intruded into the church called Theonas, 1, and there instead of holy words were uttered the praises of idols. There where the holy scriptures had been read might be heard unseemly clapping of hands with unmanly and indecent utterances. There outrages were offered to the virgins of Christ which the tongue refuses to utter. For it is a shame even to speak of them too. On only hearing of these wrongs, one of the well-disposed stopped his ears, and prayed that he might rather become deaf and have to listen to their foul language. Would that they had been content to sin in word alone, and had not surpassed the wickedness of word by deed. For insult, however bad it be, can be borne by them in whom dwells Christ's wisdom and his holy lessons. But these same villains, vessels of wrath fitted for destruction, 3, screwed up their noses, and poured out, if I may so say, as from a well head, foul noises through their nostrils, and rent the raiment from Christ's holy virgins, whose conversation gave an exact likeness of saints. They dragged them in triumph, naked, as when they were born, through all the town. They made indecent sport of them at their pleasure. Their deeds were barbarous and cruel. Did anyone in pity interfere, and urge to mercy, he was dismissed with winds. Ah, woe is me! Many a virgin underwent brutal violation, many a maid beaten on the head, with clubs laid dumb, and even their bodies were not allowed to be given up for burial, and their grief-stricken parents cannot find their corpses to this day. But why recount woes which seem small when compared with greater? Why linger over these and not hurry on to events more urgent? When you hear them, I know that you will wonder, and will stand with us long dumb, amazed at the kindness of the Lord, in not bringing all things utterly to an end. At the very altar the impious perpetrated what, as it is written, for neither happened, nor was heard of in the days of our fathers. A boy who had forsworn his sex, and would pass for a girl, with eyes, as it is written, smeared with antimony, 5, and face reddened with rouge, like their idols, in woman's dress, was set up to dance and wave his hands about and whirl round, as though he had been at the front of some disreputable stage, on the holy altar itself, where we call on the coming of the Holy Ghost, while the bystanders laughed aloud, and rudely raised unseemly shouts. But as this seemed to them really rather decorous than improper, they went on to proceedings which they reckoned in accordance with their indecency. They picked out a man, who was very famous for utter baseness, made him strip off at once all his clothes, and all his shame, and set him up as naked, as he was born on the throne of the church, and dubbed him a vile advocate against Christ. Then for divine words he uttered shameless wickedness, for awful doctrines wanton lewdness, for piety impiety, for continence fornication, adultery, foul lust, theft, teaching that gluttony and drunkenness as well as all the rest were good for man's life. 1. In this state of things, when even I had withdrawn from the church, 2. For how could I remain where troops were coming in, where mob was bribed to violence, where all were striving for gain, where mobs of heathen were making mighty promises forth, forsooth? Is sent a successor in my place. It was one named Lucius, who had bought the bishopric, as he might some dignity of this world, eager to maintain the bad character and conduct of a wolf. 3. No synod of orthodox bishops had chosen him. 4. No vote of genuine clergy, no laity had demanded him, as the laws of the church enjoin. Lucius could not make his entrance into the city without parade, and so he was appropriately escorted not by bishops, not by presbyters, not by deacons, not by multitudes of the laity. No monks preceded him chanting psalms from the scriptures, but there was as well one sedecan of our city of Alexandria, and long since degraded along with Arius, in the great and holy synod of Nicaea, and more recently raised to rule and ravage the see of Antioch, and there, 2. was Magnus the treasurer, 5, notorious for every kind of impiety, leading a vast body of troops. In the reign of Julian this Magnus had burnt the church at Brutus, 6, the famous city of Phoenicia, and, in the reign of Jovian, of blessed memory, after barely escaping decapitation by numerous appeals to the imperial compassion, had been compelled to build it up again at his own expense. Now I invoke your zeal to rise in our vindication. From what I write you ought to be able to calculate the character and extent of the wrongs committed against the Church of God, by the starting up of this Lucius, to oppose us, often rejected by your piety, and by the Orthodox bishops, or every region. He seized on a city which had just and righteous cause to regard and treat him as a foe. For he does not merely say like the blasphemous fool in the Psalms, Christ is not true God one, but, corrupt himself, he corrupted others, rejoicing in the blasphemies uttered continually against the Savior, by them, who worship the creature instead of the Creator. The scoundrel's opinions being quite on a par with those of a heathen, why should he not venture to worship a new made God? For these were the phrases with which he was publicly greeted, Welcome, Bishop, because thou deniest the Son. Serapis loves thee, and has brought thee to us, so they named their native idol. Then without an interval of delay the aforenamed Magnus, inseparable associate in the villainy of Lucius, cruel bodyguard, savage lieutenant, collected together all the multitudes committed to his care, and arrested presbyters and deacons, to the number of 19, some of whom were 80 years of age, on the charge of being concerned in some foul violation of Roman law. He constituted a public tribunal, and, in ignorance of the laws of Christians in defense of virtue, endeavored to compel them to give up the faith of their fathers which had been handed down from the apostles through the fathers to us. He even went so far as to maintain that this would be gratifying to the most merciful and clement Valens Augustus. Wretched man, he shouted, accept the doctrine of the Arians. God will pardon you even though you worship with a true worship, if you, to this not of your own accord, but, because you are compelled. There is always a defense for a responsible compulsion, while free action is responsible and much followed by accusation. Consider well these arguments, come willingly, away with all delay, subscribe the doctrine of Arius preached now by Lucius, so he introduced him by name, being well assured that if you obey you will have wealth and honor from your prince, while if you refuse you will be punished by chains, rack, torture, scourge, and cruel torments. You will be deprived of your property and possessions, you will be driven into exile, and condemned to dwell in savage regions. Thus this noble character mixed intimidation with deceit, and so endeavored to persuade and compel the people to apostatize from true religion. They however knew full well how true it is that the pain of treachery to right religion is sharper than any torment. They refused to lower their virtue and noble spirit to his trickery and threats, and were thus constrained to answer him. Cease trying to frighten us with these words, utter no more vain words. We worship no god of late arrival, or of new invention. Foam at us if you will in the vain tempest of your fury, and dash yourselves against us like a furious wind. We abide by the doctrines of true religion even unto death. We have never regarded God as impotent, or as unwise, or untrue, as at one time a father, and at another not a father, as this impious Arian teaches, making the Son a being of time, and transitory. For if, as the Ariomaniacs say, the Son is a creature, not being naturally of one substance, with the Father too will be reduced to non-existence by the non-existence of the Son, not being, as they assert, at one period a Father. But if he is ever a Father, his offspring being truly of him, and not by derivation, for God is impassible, how is not he mad and foolish who says of the Son, through whom all things came by grace into existence, there was a time when he was not? These men have truly become fatherless by falling away from our fathers throughout the world, who assembled at Nicaea, and anathematized the false doctrine of Arius, now defended by this later champion. They lay down that the Son was not, as you are now compelling us to say, of a different substance from the Father, but of one and the same. This their pious intelligence clearly perceived, and so from an adequate collation of divine terms they owned him to be consubstantial. Advancing these and other similar arguments, they were imprisoned for many days, in the hope that they might be induced to fall away from theft right mind, but rather, like the noblest of the athletes in a stadium, they crushed all fear, and from time to time, as it were anointing themselves with the thought of the bold deeds done by their fathers, through the help of holy thoughts maintained a nobler constancy in piety, and treated the rack as a training place for virtue. While they were thus struggling, and had become, as writes the blessed Paul, a spectacle to angels, and to men, 1. The whole city ran up to gaze at Christ's athletes, vanquishing by stout endurance the scourges of the judge, who was torturing them, winning by patience trophies against impiety, and exhibiting triumphs against Arians. So their savage enemy thought that by threats and torments he could subdue, and deliver them to the enemies of Christ. Thus therefore the savage and inhuman tyrant evilly entreated them by inflicting on them the tortures that his cruel ingenuity devised, while all the people stood wailing, and showing their sorrow in various ways. Then he once more mustered his troops, who were disciplined in disorder, and summoned the martyrs to trial, or, as it might rather be called, to a foregone condemnation, by the seaport, while after their fashion hired cries were raised against them by the idolaters and the Jews. On their refusal to yield to the manifest heresy of the Ariomaniacs they were sentenced, while all the people stood in tears, before the tribunal, to be deported from Alexandria, to the Phoenician Heliopolis, to a place where none of the inhabitants, who are all given over to idols, can endure so much as to hear the name of Christ. After giving them the order to embark, Magnus stationed himself at the port, for he had delivered his sentence against them in the neighborhood of the public baths. He showed them his sword unsheathed, thinking that he court thus strike terror into men, who had again and again smitten hostile demons to the ground with their two-edged blade. So he bade them put out to sea, though they had got no provisions on board, and were starting without one single comfort for their exile. Strange and almost incredible to relate, the sea was all afoam, grieved, I think, and unwilling, if I may so say, to receive the good men upon its surface, and so have part or lot in an unrighteous sentence. Now even to the ignorant was made manifest the savage purpose of the judge, and it may truly be said at this, the heavens stood astonished. 3. The whole city groaned, and is lamenting to this day. Some men beating on their breast with one hand, after another raised a mighty noise, others lifted up at once their hands and eyes to heaven in testimony of the wrong inflicted on them, and so saying in all but words, "Hear, O heavens, and give ear, O earth, 1. What unlawful deeds are being done?" Now all was weeping, and wailing, singing, and sighing sounded through all the town, and from every eye flowed a river of tears which threatened to overwhelm the very sea with its tide. There was the aforesaid Magnus, on the port ordering the rowers to hoist the sails, and up went a mingled cry of maids and matrons, old men and high young, all sobbing and lamenting together, and the noise of the multitude overwhelmed the roar raised by the waves on the foaming sea. So the martyrs sailed off for Heliopolis, where every man is given over to superstition, to where flourish the devil's ways of pleasure, and where the situation of the city, surrounded on all sides by mountains that approach the sky, is fitted for the terrifying lairs of wild beasts. All the friends they left behind now alike in public in the middle of the town, and each in private apart groaned and uttered words of grief, and were even forbidden to weep, at the order of Palladius, prefect of the city, who happened himself to be a man quite given over to superstition. Many of the mourners were first arrested and thrown into prison, and then scourged, torn with carding combs, tortured, and, champions, as they were of the church in their holy enthusiasm, were dispatched to the mines of Phanesis, 3, and Proconesis, 4. Most of them were monks, devoted to a life of ascetic solitude, and were about 23 in number. Not long afterwards the deacon, who had been sent by our beloved Damasus, Bishop of Rome, to bring us letters of consolation and communion, was led publicly through the town by executioners, with his hands tied behind his back like some notorious criminal. After sharing the tortures inflicted on murderers, he was terribly scourged with stones and bits of lead about his very neck. 5. He went on board ship, to sail, like the rest, with the mark of the sacred cross upon his brow. With none to aid and none to tempt him, he was dispatched to the copper mines of Phanesis. During the tortures inflicted by the magistrate on the tender bodies of little boys, some have been left lying on the spot deprived of holy rites of burial, though parents and brothers and kinsfolk, and indeed the whole city, begged that this one consolation might be given them. But alas for the inhumanity of the judge, if indeed he can be called judge, who only condemns. They who had contended nobly for the true religion were assigned a worse fate than a murderer's, their bodies lying, as they did, unburied. The glorious champions were thrown to be devoured by beasts and birds of prey. 1. Those who were anxious for conscience' sake to express sympathy with the parents were punished by decapitation, as though they had broken some law. What Roman law, nay what foreign sentiment, ever inflicted punishment for the expression of sympathy with parents? What instance is there of the perpetration of so illegal a deed by any one of the ancients? The male children of the Hebrews were indeed once ordered to be slain by Pharaoh, but his edict was suggested by envy, and by fear. How far greater the inhumanity of our day, man of his! How preferable, if there be a choice in unrighteousness, their wrongs to ours! How much better, if what is illegal can be called good or bad, though in truth iniquity is always iniquity! I am writing what is incredible, inhuman, awful, savage, barbarous, pitiless, cruel. But in all this the votaries of the Arian madness pranced, as it were, with proud exultation, while the whole city was lamenting. For, as it is written in Exodus, there was not a house in which there was not one dead too. The men whose appetite for iniquity was never satisfied planned new agitation. Ever wreaking their evil will in evil deeds, they darted the peculiar venom of their iniquity at the bishops of the province, using the aforesaid treasurer Magnus as the instrument of their unrighteousness. Some they delivered to the Senate, some they trapped at their good pleasure, leaving no stone unturned in their anxiety to hunt in all from every quarter to impiety, going about in all directions, and like the devil, the proper father of heresy, they sought whom they might devour. 1. In all, after many fruitless efforts, they drove into exile to Diocesaria, 2. A city inhabited by Jews, murderers of the Lord, 11 of the bishops of Egypt, all of them men, who from childhood to old age had lived an ascetic life, in the desert, had subdued their inclinations to pleasure by reason, and by discipline, had fearlessly preached the true faith of piety, had imbibed the pious doctrines, had again, and again won victory against demons, forever putting the adversary out of countenance by their virtue, and publicly posting the Arian heresy, by wisest argument. Yet like hell, 3, not satisfied with the death of their brethren, fools, and madmen, as they were, eager to win a reputation by their evil deeds, they tried to leave memorials in all the world of their own cruelty. For lo, now they roused the imperial attention against certain clerics of the Catholic Church, who were living at Antioch, together with some excellent monks, who came forward to testify against their evil deeds. They got these men banished in Diocesaria, 4, in Pontus, where they were soon deprived of life in consequence of the sterility of the country. Such tragedies were enacted at this period, fit indeed to be consigned to silence and oblivion, but given a place in history for the condemnation of the men who wagged their tongues against the only begotten, and infected, as they were with the raving madness of blasphemy, strive not only to aim their shafts at the Master of the universe, but further waged a truceless war against his faithful servants.